Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. And it is all about compliance. Folks, I want you to understand the paradigm here. There has never been a point in time in the last century until the framers started dying off, personal accountability fell out of favor. In other words, we kind of wanted to have politicians because they were at the trough of this big, huge printing press to be able to give us money and do things for us, bring us jobs, and using government to make our lives better. We kind of fell into that trap of the Titler's democracy and or the cycle of democracy. But to be clear, the Constitution does not allow these things to happen. In other words, if they're doing something that they have no authority to do, it's unconstitutional, it's fraud. And so we need to wipe the slate clean. But what has to happen, you cannot have your liberties back until we get accountability out of our public servants, period. We can't take the federal government back until we get our state government in compliance that we can hold every person in the state government accountable to their oath. That includes the governor. That includes the courts. That includes every person who is under oath can be and must be held accountable. And we can't do that at the state level until we do it at the county level. And it will never happen at the county level until you demand accountability. We're not talking about transparency. See, transparency is a completely different word. Transparency is seeing the abysmal, you know, debt and seeing the, you know, all of these atrocities. Transparency is only having the vision and seeing that things are corrupt. This is bad. It's like, you know, taking the, you know, the little filters off of our nose, and now we can smell how rotten our government is. It's about taking and removing filtration so that we can see, smell how bad our government is. Accountability is how we actually transform our government into a functioning government that was laid out and designed. Now, there's been lots of people. This goes in kind of in line with the metaphor I provide regarding education. The progressives have been working for over a century to create the debauchery and the state of immoral or moral turpitude in our education system. And they've been succeeding. I mean, look at the great success that they've created. And the real problem is, instead of actually fixing the problem by getting government out of education, everybody's convinced that the conservatives, giving them control over education so that they can make millions of dollars, you know, from that trough of government, unconstitutional. Give them the power, let them actually invoke a theocratic education, a moral education system, when neither is tenable under our Constitution. In other words, the education system as it is today shouldn't even exist. They have no authority to be doing what they are doing. What is the greater threat? The fact that they have created something outside their authority, or who's in control of it? Because it's going to constantly ebb and flow, and even though we have seen that the progressives have successfully and incrementally basically decayed the morals of our society, getting our society to become moral using education is almost an untenable proposition. It's just, we can't get there from here. But if we get rid of education and we get compliance of the Constitution, then we can start actually healing. We can actually start restoring our mores that really made this nation what it is. This all boils down, if we distill this down to the essence of what this is all about, holding people accountable, it is all about full compliance to the entire Constitution. Don't let people fool you that, hey, the most important thing, the only thing we need to worry about is maintaining our guns at the expense of our children, or vice versa. And it's not just a vice versa, folks. It's not an either or. It's a multiple or a multitude of problems. Do we want them to regulate our labor? As soon as they regulated our labor, they started controlling our economy. Because as they started regulating labor, it only took a couple of decades for them to say, you know what? We're now establishing a minimum wage. And now every state has a minimum. And all of this is all unconstitutional. It's the same thing with it's nice to have a house that can withstand a hurricane if you live in a hurricane area. And you're pretty stupid living in a house that can't withstand a hurricane in a hurricane area where it's going to happen. It's the same thing with having a house that, you know, can't sustain a tornado. It's almost impossible if you can't afford it. So what do you do? It's almost impossible. If you can't afford that kind of house and you need to live there because that's the soul. This is the bread and essence of your family and your heritage in being a part of a family farm and, you know, growing food for the people. It's a very noble cause. So if you can't afford that tornado-proof home, then you have to mitigate. You have to at least be able to preserve your life by creating, you know, tornado root cellars or what have you so that you can get to safety, so that you can survive and rebuild if you get hit. I mean, we've got to mitigate things, but to think that government owes us our job, they owe us our house, they owe us our food, means that we owe them our essence. We can't have it both ways, folks. For you to maintain your essence, you need to be fully accountable. And that's the same thing with our government. Our government must be fully accountable to those powers delegated, and they were limited for a very specific purpose. And we're literally going through the conversations as these very wise and equally educated men discussed and debated the concepts. Just in the past day, 2 days or so, we've already discovered how this idea of Madison's bicameral legislative body and this new form of government that he proposed has transferred from this lower house being built or being appointed by the state legislature. Common sense has prevailed, and actually they've commented and have migrated towards that lower house being chosen by the people. Now, in this point in the discussion in Congress or in this convention regarding Congress or what will ultimately be Congress, is how do they select the members or appoint the members of that second house? If the people are going to elect their representatives in the lower house, the upper house, they have to figure out how that's to be. And the current plan, in Madison's plan in the convention, as it was presented by Governor Randolph, that the lower house would select those people that would occupy those seats in the upper house. Now, let me be clear here, because either of these potential ideas, i.e. if the state legislature gets to appoint the lower house, and then the lower house basically appoints the upper house, whoever has the most representatives will have the most control over each of those seats. And if it's basically a majority rule, which means that almost every single one of those seats in the upper house will be controlled by those states that have the highest population, those states that only, you know, very little population, Delaware and so forth, they won't even make a peep. I mean, maybe collectively between all six or seven of the small states might have a voting block where they might be able to protect themselves a little bit. But compared to the masses of these larger states, good luck. In other words, the whole point is, and this is why the small states were very apprehensive, is that they saw that the big states would gain full control and that they would literally roll over the small states and wipe out their sovereignty. Because in that upper house, the majority of the votes would be coming from those populated states. And that's why they would constantly, and the same thing with the president. All of the votes for both houses, because the population is now ruling, and these little states saw, no way, this is just not acceptable. You're taking away our sovereignty and our voice in our government. So we're seeing the debate on how, and that's where we are right now. We started this off on June 7th, and so we're seeing June 7th, 1787. And we're seeing how they're discussing what is the proper way of defining or who sits in this upper house, the Senate, that we call it today. And so that's kind of where we left off. And so today we have Tammy with us, but we don't have Sean. And so welcome back, Tammy.
Thank you.
Tammy, the extraordinaire reader and pontificator of politics and all things concerned. Anyway, we kind of left off with Madison's comment. And so when we kind of look at Madison, he talked about at the very, this was a long kind of comment, but his final comment was, when it depends on the degree of political authority lodged in them, the smaller number, the greater the weight. In other words, he's talking about when there's less people in a legislative body, the greater the weight they hold. In other words, the individual holds. When it becomes larger, then the less weight they hold. In other words, you know, you actually have to start politicking. The larger the body, the more difficult it is to control. It's kind of like herding cats. Because you have to get people to, you know, go your way on this, and then you have to make more compromises and so forth. When you have a small oligarchy, you actually have a, I'll just call it, a huge power cell where, you know, if these folks are all thinking the same, it's they're gonna rule with a heavy hand. The only way that we can actually have, I would think, proper representation, we kind of talked about this several times, and they haven't gotten there yet because they haven't even gotten to the amount of apportionment. They haven't even hit apportionment yet. What is the perfect? Because a perfect Republican form of government is one-to-one. Technically, that's a democracy, even though, you know, you're cutting everything in half to say, okay, half the people will vote for the other person. In other words, one-to-one. But there's got to be a sweet spot in how many people can be represented where they can actually have their voice and not be dismissed and be truly represented. What is that perfect number of representation? Well, most people would say the lower the number, the better. I agree with that. The lower the number...
One-to-one?
Yeah, one-to-one is good, but that's way too low because that's just one step away from a full democracy, one step away. So how many steps do we go? And when we look at New Hampshire in the state legislature, it's around 1,700, 1 to 1,700. That's pretty good. Why aren't states that way? As a matter of fact, when we look at technology today, why aren't states actually embracing this concept? Because when you look at these counties and when you look at legislative districts, by melting them together with gerrymandering and everything else, you can silence the discontent in these small communities, even though they may be small in the grand picture. If we're talking about 1,700, there's plenty of people within small communities that would exceed that, and their voices would start rising out of these pockets, these large population center pockets, where they'd actually start getting representation that would challenge the paradigm that right now they have no voice because the majority of the people, in the population center just silence them. They literally are silenced. That makes sense, right?
Mm-hmm.
So when you're looking at a congressional seat, and a congressional seat is 700,000 people, and you're looking at a congressional seat that covers a very large rural area, you're probably going to find that the majority of the people in that rural area, if you broke it down into small, you know, 30,000, and they're all Republican, you're probably going to still have all Republican. But when you go to a population center like Seattle or Portland or Chicago or New York or even L.A., I mean, shoot, in the L.A. area, there's a county called Orange County that is very Republican, but right now it's actually because of the way they've gerrymandered, Orange County comes across as a blue county. San Diego has become a blue county by the way they, cross these, I'll just say, these communities to water down those voices that would be contrary. So this is how gerrymandering works. And as a matter of fact, the person we're going to start off with is Eldridge Gerry, which is the father of the name gerrymandering, even though we say his name is Gerry. But anyway, let's go into Gerry and his two cents on how to populate this second chamber. Go ahead.
Four modes of appointing the Senate have been mentioned. One, by the first branch of the national legislature. This would create a dependence contrary to the end proposed. Two, by the national executive. This is a stride towards monarchy that a few will think of. Three, by the people. The people have two great interests, the landed interests and the commercial, including the stockholders. To draw both branches from the people will leave no security to the latter interests. The people being chiefly composed of the landed interest and erroneously supposing that the other interests are adverse to it.
So if you stop right there, what he just said really speaks loudly about democracy. When you actually, because there are two types of interests, there's the people and then there's the commercial or the business and or those people that are creating jobs, farmers, factories, what have you. And so when it comes to this, how important are jobs? Pretty important, right? Because this is how people go out, earn money. This is how people put a roof over their head. This is how they put food on the table with a job. Now, if you have your own business, like a farmer or a rancher, you're self-employed. There are those that are self-employed. That means you are an employer. In other words, you have commercial interests. And there are organizations like the Cattlemen's Bureau or whatever, the association, whatever they call them in your state. But these groups of individual farmers, ranchers, what have you, create these associations so that they can politically come together to kind of, protect themselves from the predators that are out to basically, get us off of meat completely. Like, we need to eat the grass. Anyway, when you look at the disparity in the numbers of those who are creating jobs and providing money for those who need it versus those who need money to put the roof over their head and so forth, the employee is always going to be the larger voter bloc. Does that make sense, correct? So in other words, the constituent, the noisy wheels will be the voters. And he's pointing out that if you actually have an upper chamber and a lower chamber that is being driven by the noisy wheel, the people, instead of the commercial interest, then the whole point of having two separate bodies is stupid because the people are going to get their way in both houses. But by separating them, and this is where the light hasn't clicked on yet, by separating the commercial interest to the government body, the way it is today, the way it should be today, so at your state level, if your Senate is driven by the county commissioners who are then very interested in ensuring that there's enough, jobs, there's enough work going on in their community, Because they don't, right now, your county commissioners have no voice in your Senate. It's the people. And if you start looking at your state and the employment ratios of your state, you'll find that the less populated counties have a higher percentage of unemployment because they're not being represented. They're not being protected by, you know, they're not able to protect their commercial interests. And so by not being able to do that in the Senate affects them directly. You'll always find that in the population center, because there's more focus via the population, we need the jobs more than they do. We got more people here. This is how things, you literally create an advantage big time towards the population. And that's why you see that population, or I should say employment in the population centers, because I've actually looked at the maps. And population centers always have a better unemployment rate than most of the very rural areas. And so anyway, what he's trying to point out here is that if you separate them, the commercial interest from the people's interest in the government, then that's smart. Because now you can keep kind of an even keel and checks and balances. But when you consolidate them, one side will always roll over the other side, and the takers will take everything from the creators or the makers. Always. That's the Tytler cycle. This is why I've said this several times. If anybody understands Tytler cycle of democracy, democracy always destroys itself because the people want everything and they can't have it. And they don't realize until they've destroyed themselves that they realize, oh, I guess we can't have everything. That's the point of destruction. This is a key thing that I wanted to just highlight, that he's kind of pointing out the necessity of separating out of the people, you know, these two different groups, the landed interest or the people, you know, that are trying to survive, and the commercial interests. Okay, so go ahead.
Okay.
Number four.
Number four, by the individual legislatures, the elections being carried through this refinement will be most likely to provide some check in favor of the commercial interests against the landed, without which oppression will take place and no free government can last long where that is the case. He was therefore in favor of the last.
Okay. So, when we look at the state legislature selecting those who go into the federal Senate, that the common sense, and he's absolutely right here, the common sense is if you want to have checks and balances, then, and you want to make sure that the jobs and duties, you know, like the trade, who has responsibility over making treaties over trade? If you give it to the people screw it up because they don't care about the interests of the employers and the businesses and so forth. That's one of the reasons why the Senate makes sure they handle all of the trade treaties, period. So when you look at the duties of the different legislatures in Congress, the Senate, their focus is ensuring that they're going to take, you know, care of the interests of the, you know, the jobs and those interests of the state, where the people, their interest is whether they go to war or not, how much taxes do they have to pay, you know, how much government is going to be created. And keeping these things in check and balance is what's critical. Now, today we don't even have a democracy. What we have is we have this, I'll call it lobbyist, you know, the big money wins, right? Because we have a government for sale. And though everybody thinks that, you know, I should say, those who support the democracy, the model and the socialists and those types of people, we're going into break. So let me finish this idea or this concept when we come back, because this actually just kind of hit the news in print regarding American politics, because American politics is reeking that our government is literally and has been for sale for decades and decades. We'll be right back after this short promo. Thank you so much.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so leave it to our entertainers to always, you know, poke their nose into business that they really don't even understand, but they like to come across like they do. And they like to make a point that really sounds, you know, like, wow, that, you know, that really makes sense. Wow, this guy really, he must know what he's talking about. Roger Waters just poked his nose into American politics because he basically pointed his finger of judgment at American politics and says this, quote, "America is not a democracy." I'm going to stop right there. Roger Waters believes that we're supposed to be a democracy. This little how he knows that we're to be a Republican form of government, not a Democratic form of government. The only place where democracy functions in America is the selection of our representatives in our legislative body. In other words, we don't have a single body. They have the House of Lords and the House of Commons that represents the people. We actually have, like we're talking about now, we actually have a legislative body that is supposed to represent the people in one house and is supposed to represent the government of the people in the other house to basically go over this very specific thing to keep in check. So we don't have a democracy. But he's now saying that we don't even have a democracy. And it's not that he's wrong. But the fact is that the players are playing because we do have a democracy. What we've got is a Bolshevik revolution. But what he goes on and says, this is him again, you can buy the presidency. Donald Trump did, and he buys it from his AIPAC money, from oligarchical money, and from donor money. The fact that you're allowed to pour millions and millions into politics makes it possible for it to be, makes it impossible for it to be democratic. Well, hold on here. The actual reality is it wasn't just Donald Trump that bought a presidency. This goes all the way back to, you know, the parties back in the 1850s where they kind of seized control, and that's when they started basically selling off politics, where the Democratic and Republican Party in the 1850s decided that they were going to have primaries. They were going to squeeze out all the other candidates out there, that only a Democrat and only a Republican would ever sit in that White House, and eventually they would control access to all seats, which is what we have today. So Roger Waters is pointing his crooked finger, and it's hitting all the wrong spots, because bottom line, when you look at in the past 20, 40, 50 years, money has gone into buy Senate seats. It is money that buys the House of Representatives. It is money that is buying all of these different positions, because our courts have literally opened it up to allow money and corporations to actually buy the votes of America. In other words, they've made everything possible to sell American politics, sell America downriver. Bottom line, this is not supposed to be happening. As a matter of fact, if we are truly a Republican form of government, I'm getting on my soapbox here. I wrote this in the Bill of Rights for the 21st century, that in a Republican form of government, the only people that can spend a penny in the election of an individual of their election area, their own representative, because technically we should not be voting for our governor. Technically, the way the exemplar is we should have an electoral college. I mentioned this with Sean just yesterday, that if we had an electoral college at the state level, the electoral college would then choose who the executive is, and then the executive would actually fill his cabinet. He would appoint the attorney general, secretary of state, just like the president does. And this way, the president or the governor can create the team for executing the laws of the union, because if we keep everybody in their little play box, in their little box of sand where they can play, the only thing the executive can do is execute the laws. And it's the same thing with the courts. The courts can only rule upon the cases that they have jurisdiction over. In other words, those court doors don't open unless they have jurisdiction. In other words, if we kept everybody in their box, we would have the best government in the world, even though the world is so crappy. I mean, it is sewage. The entire politics of the world is such sewage that America still has the better government than all of them. And we're holding our nose here. So when Roger Waters goes down this path of talking and speaking in something that he thinks he really understands, it only points out how little he really understands. Because, again, getting back to this Bill of Rights for the 21st century, if you have an election in your city, your county, and or your congressional seat, the only money that should be able to be injected is the money that is organic to that area. And the only people that have the ability to endorse and be involved in the campaign are people who are organic to the area. In other words, if President Trump comes along and says, I endorse this governor, he should be basically charged with foreign influence, because he's not organic to the state that he's trying to influence, and he should be slapped on the hands. That is trying to influence an election that you have no business being involved in. Only the people that live in that state have the ability and should be ones that are supporting this. So anytime somebody wants to put their nose in an election that is not of their concern, they should get their hand slapped, and or we need to start actually building some teeth to this, to where they lose their ability to be in office, they lose their ability to even vote. If we start taking our government seriously and start guarding our government the way we're supposed to have it, then as we make sure that nobody can throw money into that election, nobody, unless they're organic to the area, and that the money that they have is organic to them. So as we break this all down, as they get elected, the only people that can walk into their door are those people that are organic to that area. In other words, if you have a business in the legislative district or within your county, and you're going and seeing your state legislator, and they say, oh, yeah, okay, hey, you're my constituent, come on in. But when somebody walks or knocks on that door that does not belong and is not a part of they're not a true constituent, not from that area, organically, then I can't talk to you. You have no business to be here to try to influence me or to talk to me about anything. Now, it's another thing if you're just, a contractor executing a bill or executing a contract that you have. That's one thing. But if it's for real business, it's one thing. But if we started guarding our representation and access to our representatives and our public officials, then we would actually have the Republican form of government that they gave us, that they designed for us. We would actually be living in the dream government that nobody could even imagine how beautiful it would be, because we would be so protected from these self-made kings and these dolts that, you know, make too much money because they can come up with some snappy song that everybody can tap their toe to. As far as I'm concerned, we weigh too much credibility to the people that have great marketing plans or what have you, where they can suck up money and just become obscenely rich. They're, we got to stop looking at them like they're these gods. As a matter of fact, we need to look at them as leeches, because that's all they are. That's all they are leeches, trying to suck up as much of your disposable income so that they can ingratiate themselves in a lifestyle that they really don't deserve. But I'm stepping down off the soapbox now, and I'm looking for Tammy. I think I've lost Tammy, because I think she's...
I'm here.
Oh, you had no idea I was going to go there. But I really get upset.
I mean, I agree with you that President Trump shouldn't be endorsing anyone.
Or the California PAC. I mean, when you look at, you know, there was the senator in Georgia, the two senators in Georgia that were elected by California money, the same thing in Alabama. I mean, this happens all the time. This, folks, if you want a Republican form of government, you actually have to start creating laws that constrain any kind of influence outside of those organic things of the election area. In other words, if it's not the person or a business within that election area, period, then that's foreign influence. And you need to charge those people to say, and we need to create maybe an amendment. Maybe an amendment to the U.S. Constitution that it is a federal offense for anybody that is not within the election area to try to influence an election that is considered foreign influence and will be charged. And maybe that would even be a charge of treason.
Yeah.
So when China,
Trump has endorsed a certain governor here, in a certain candidate for governor here in Wyoming, and super hoping that the people of Wyoming prove that we're not going to just vote for people because they're endorsed by.
Well, so actually, one thing I know about Trump, because he did this before, and it's a business plan. If you have a set amount of dollars, if you can bring a set amount of dollars into your campaign organically to yourself, then he will support you. And so
that's terrible.
It is terrible, absolutely. But see, that's how he succeeded. He succeeded by creating these basic thresholds for what the cost of that campaign would be at a national level, state level, you know, local level, congressional level, what have you. And so this is exactly how they decide to get behind somebody. They don't get behind somebody because they're the best person for the job. This is why we can't have movements of true change. It's all about money. So,
yeah, that's terrible.
Yes, and if you talk, I've talked to a few candidates that ran for congressional seat. The only reason we have this bum in Congress, his name's Bumgartner, so he's a bum, and he fits the T. I mean, I know that there's people in this congressional district that love him. This is his first time because we finally got rid of Kathy McMorris Rodgers. Kathy McMorris Rodgers was not representing the people of this congressional district. She was representing herself, and now Bumgartner's in there doing the same thing. And he's giving a little bit of face time, but the more he feels more established and empowered and enabled, the more he's going to be turning the spigot on. He's going to walk out of that place just like everybody else, a multimillionaire. Because it's all about the money for this guy. It's not about the Constitution. Mm-hmm. And we need to plan to get rid of this guy now. Just like, you know, at least you guys have a decent representative, Harriet Hageman.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately... Yeah. Unfortunately, she's looking to run into the Senate, and it's not that, you know, you can't use somebody like that, but to give up your representative to who might suck into that. Anyway, I digress. I mean, here I am I speak as a political pundit and talk about races across the nation. If somebody is going to, so this is where I believe the only latitude for somebody like me or anybody is we need to speak and place context of the Constitution, because that's the one legal thing that these people are supposed to do. They're not. Harriet Hageman is not obligated to support her constituents, you know, if they get hit by, you know, some natural disaster of 200 degrees below zero where everything literally freezes and breaks and says, I need to bring federal money. No, she doesn't have the authority to do that. Her legal obligation is to support and defend that Constitution and operate within those powers delegated. If those powers aren't delegated, then her going out and trying to get money for something that is outside of that would be treason. And we, the people, this goes back to what I was saying regarding people living in tornado areas. You know, you have the responsibility, and if you want to get government to the point where they're going to give you that tornado-proof home, where they're going to, you know, make sure that you have food on your table, I wouldn't eat that food anymore. And I wouldn't want to live in that home anymore, because it would literally be about controlling you and monitoring you, because that's exactly what government does. We don't. Mm-hmm. We should not want government to be able to do those things. We created a government that kept them limited to the things that they could and should do for us, because they would do it best. Who fights wars better than government?
There you go.
I mean, we see around the world where ragtag, you know, little, I'll call them revolutionaries, try to go out and fight a war. And then the government comes in and just, you know, hits them like a fly swatter. When it comes down to giving government very specific powers and functions, the framers got it right. They gave them the necessary powers and functions that they could serve the union in protecting the union's sovereignty and the union's interest. And that's it. When we start going down and trying to give them the ability and power to do things for different purposes, whether they be noble or what have you, this is where we start making big mistakes. And as a matter of fact, the interesting thing is, and the beautiful thing is, that there's never been an amendment to the Constitution for all of these noble things that they're doing for us, which means that we have the ability to snap our fingers, say, you must cease and desist, you have no authority to do that. And we're coming and removing everybody that is wanting to continue the status quo and continue business as usual. Either you shut it down or you're gone. Done. And you know, this isn't a pipe dream. This is why I started the show off this way. The day you start demanding accountability from your local politicians so that you can take control of your county, and then that's what, you know, across the state, counties do this, then that's when you can start controlling your state, and as states across the republic start doing this, then we can take full control and full accountability and keeping government within the powers delegated, and then that's it. This is how we get our government back. You can't do it any other way. Voting Republican will not do it until the Republican Party becomes the party that is all about accountability to the oath of office and to the supreme law of the state constitution, federal constitution, so forth, county constitution. Anyway. So I digress, and I apologize, folks. I will let Tammy get back to these good things that she's going to share with us. So Mr. Dickinson, who kind of started this off, now kind of, you know, comes back around to him. So let's see what Mr. Dickinson wants to point out. Because Mr. Gary made a great salient point that by, you know, separating or by maintaining, if the people are going to be in one house, let the state government be in the other house and control that. Mr. Dickinson pipes in. Go ahead.
Okay. Preservation of the states in a certain degree of agency is indispensable. It will produce that collision between the different authorities which should be wished for in order to check each other. To attempt to abolish the states altogether would degrade the councils of our country, would be impracticable, would be ruinous. He compared the proposed national system to the solar system, in which the states were the planets and ought to be left to move freely in their proper orbits. The gentleman from Pennsylvania, Mr. Wilson, wished, he said, to extinguish these planets. If the state governments were excluded from all agency in the national one and all power drawn from the people at large, the consequence would be that the national government would move in the same direction as the state governments now do, and would run into all the same mischief. The reform would only unite the 13 small streams into one great current, pursuing the same course without any opposition whatever. He adhered to the opinion that the Senate ought to be composed of a large number, and that their influence from family weight and other causes would be increased thereby. He did not admit that the tribunes lost their weight in proportion as their number was augmented, and gave a historical sketch of this institution. If the reasoning of Mr. Madison was good, it would prove that the number of the Senate ought to be reduced below 10, the highest number of the tribunitial court.
Yes. Okay, so he's talking about keeping it below 10, and he's kind of agreeing, but I don't think he sees the bigger picture yet. So Mr. Wilson then kind of opines. Go ahead.
The subject, it must be owned, is surrounded with doubts and difficulties, but we must surmount them. The British government cannot be our model. We have no materials for a similar one. Our manners, our laws, the abolition of entails, and the primogeniture, the whole genius of the people, are opposed to it. He did not see the danger of the states being devoured by the national government. On the contrary, he wished to keep them from devouring. He wished to keep them from devouring the national government. He was not, however, for extinguishing these planets, as was supposed by Mr.
Dickinson.
Dickinson. Neither did he, on the other hand, believe that they would warm or enlighten the sun. Within their proper orbits, they must still be suffered to act for subordinate purposes for which their existence is made essential by the great extent of our country. He could not comprehend in what manner the landed interests would be rendered less predominant in the Senate by an election through the medium of the legislatures than by the people themselves. If the legislatures, as was now complained, sacrificed the commercial to the landed interests, what reason was there to expect such a choice from them as would defeat their own views? He was for an election by the people in large districts, which would be most likely to obtain men of intelligence and uprightness, subdividing the districts only for the accommodations of voters.
Yeah, and see, he's actually in favor of more involvement of the people and giving the people the say. In other words, he's for the traditional Republican. His paradigm is the traditional Republican form of government where the people possess and control their representation. And so, there had been a couple of comments already prior that kind of pointed towards, you know, the danger of that. Mr. Gary, I think, probably did the best so far. And now let's see what Mr. Madison weighs in on this. Go ahead. And you may be muted, but that's okay.
Whoops, sorry.
Go ahead.
Mr. Madison could as little comprehend in what manner family weight, as desired by Mr. Dickinson, would be more certainly conveyed into the Senate through elections by the state legislatures than in some other modes. The true question was in what mode the best choice would be made. If an election by the people or through any other channel than the state legislatures promised as uncorrupt and impartial a preference of merit, there could surely be no necessity for an appointment by those legislatures. Nor was it apparent that a more useful check would be derived through that channel than from the people through some other. The great evils complained of were that the state legislatures run into schemes of paper money and whenever solicited by the people, and sometimes without even the sanction of the people. Their influence then, instead of checking a like propensity in the national legislature, may be expected to promote it. Nothing can be more contradictory than to say that the national legislature
without
a proper check.
Uh-huh.
I think that's what it's saying.
Yep,
without a proper check will follow the example of the state legislature And in the same breath, that the state legislatures are the only proper check.
Okay. So at this point, now see, again, this actually exposes the failings within the states, because the states don't have a bicameral legislative body representing the landed interest and the commercial interest. In other words, the people and the government and businesses. Therefore, the people in the states, you know, having a democracy and not really... When you see the composition of the different states, because they're going to expose this in the convention and they're going to expose this in the ratification debates, I'm exposing this to the detail of exactly how each state at the time of the convention and ratification of the Constitution, how each state government was basically formed at that point in time. So that you'll see that... They didn't have, I mean, they were really more democracy republics than anything else. They didn't have the three branches and the checks and balances or anything like that. Nor did they have the ingenuity of creating a bicameral legislative body to actually create internal checks and balances as well. They ended up having to basically change their form to go into that better form of government. And every state did. Every state changed their form of government and created a bicameral legislative body. Most of them got it right, kind of. You know, they got close to getting it right. But even still, people did not understand. It didn't just jump out on the pages why they were creating a Senate and a House of Representatives, and that the Senate would kind of represent the county. In many cases, it was always about representing the people of the county and the people of the county. In other words, when I look at most of the state makeup of the apportionment for the two houses, there was not a definitive, the county commissioners would appoint their senators. Like the federal constitution. Folks, you want to have a better state constitution? Use the U.S. Constitution as the template that your county commissioners or supervisors will appoint your senator to represent you. And all counties have equal representation. So if necessary, you may want to have, you know, two senators to represent you and have kind of an offset, you know, so that you don't vote for both senators at the same time, so that you could literally change out and not have continuity, those types of things. But the point is if we use the U.S. Constitution as the exemplar, then we're rock solid in protecting our liberties and protecting ourselves. Now, we're at the end of the show. So when we come back, we're going to dive into the plans. I believe it's the New Jersey and the Sherman Compromise and so forth. That's what we're going to get into next, I believe. But hopefully this starts to make sense. I mean, these guys, this is the epiphanies. The windows of heaven are starting to open up so that they can start seeing a better path forward in creating a government with checks and balances that will preserve and protect our liberties. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description
of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.